Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Interesting conversation ahead of us today. Very excited. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author with us. We're going to be talking about three different cases and about the control to which its victims were under by their perpetrators and why it wasn't just so easy to walk away. That's a big question we get thrown in all these cases. Why didn't they just walk away? Why didn't they just... Well, it's a bit deeper than that. And we're going to get into that on three different cases. We're going to talk about Micah Miller a little bit and the alleged coercive control of J.P. Miller. We're going to talk about Maggie Murdaugh. And yeah, trust me, we're aware. Big news this morning as if we're doing this. Alec Murdaugh going back to trial for what is now called the alleged murder of Maggie and Paul. He is no longer a convicted murderer. The Supreme Court of South Carolina this morning has overturned that 5-0. We got a whole piece on that on the feed. If you want to read about it, listen to it. It is there. Go ahead and dive in. We got a lot of diving in to do as we get ready to take dive number two as we go visit Resort Murdaugh for a second time. That'll be interesting. But we'll get to what kept Maggie there. Because if you remember in that case, there was a lot of talk about her being unhappy, her living a separate life towards the end, literally her end. We're going to get into that. And we're also going to be discussing what was going on in the Corey Richens case with Eric Richens and Asa Elrup as well. All people falling victim to people, controlling them in one way or another. Like I said, Siobhan Scott with us, her latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. And this is based on a piece you just put out on your Substack, Spotlight on Psychology. That's where you can find it under Substack. It's also one of the linked Substacks on our Substack. So if you want to go to ourshiddenkillers.substack.com, link is in the description. You will find your link over to Siobhan's. Go subscribe and check that out. And Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, as always with us to help us break all of this down. I'll ask about your reactions to Murdaugh when we get to that segment that's coming up next. Let's first talk about J.P. Miller, John Paul Miller, and Micah Miller, and those accusations that are there. Why doesn't knowing save you? That's the question at the center of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Micah Miller told police her husband was grooming her. She used that word. She filed for divorce, and according to a federal indictment, J.P. Miller allegedly harassed her for 528 days straight. And he's pled not guilty to all of those charges, by the way. Always maintained his innocence in all this, and the charges are still out there, and the trial is still ahead of us. But Micah couldn't see it, just as most people can't see it when they're in those sort of situations. She could name it, and she still went back. Mm-hmm. That's not a Micah Miller problem. That's a human wiring problem.
Very much.
Siobhan, you've written exactly about this in your Substack, Spotlight on Psychology, Why Intelligent People Stay in Abusive Relationships and the Science Behind That Trap. And I read it the other day and I said, you know, this applies to so many cases we have. Let's kind of just use this as framework and the cases as framework so we can kind of dive into this, not only discussing the cases, but discussing how this really applies to everybody in their lives, because I think we're all touched by this in one way or another. Let's start with what was going on in the world of Micah. Micah could name what was happening to her. She used the word groomed in a police report. And she still went back. I think a lot of people hear that and can't make any sort of sense of it. So let's start there. Why doesn't knowing save you?
Yeah. And I'll raise my hand as being one of those humans who has had this occur in my life. You probably have. I mean, it really is normal for people to have this disconnect between what they know and what they feel. And that's really what we're getting into here, I think, with all these cases. We have two separate operating systems in the brain, and they often do not coordinate very well together, if at all. And one is our marvelous prefrontal cortex, which is a newer part of the brain. And that's the meaning evolutionarily. It evolved much later than the other parts of the brain. And this is the logical part. This is the part that can go to school, study, gain knowledge, make good decisions, weigh the pros and cons. But that's not the part that attaches. The part that attaches, what we call love, I prefer the term attachment because it's often something that is really, it doesn't look like what we think love should look like. But that is the limbic system. And the limbic system is driven by neural hormones. You know, we talk about, oh, but I had such chemistry with this person. I always freak out when I hear somebody, oh, we bonded because of chemistry.
You saw me give a little chuckle there too. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. You're talking about endogenous opioids. You're talking about dopamine, and you're talking about oxytocin. These are neural hormones that I think evolutionarily developed to keep people procreating, to keep people hooking up, to keep people having babies. So survival of the species. But the problem is that those two parts of the brain often work very separately. And so someone can know someone with their thinking brain and say, gee, you know, he hasn't had a job in 10 years. He yells and screams. He breaks things. He's not very nice. But then there are those times when he's wonderful. And that's when the person becomes very attached. And that attachment can completely undermine your life and in some cases get you killed.
One of the hardest things for people on the outside to understand, you know, are the good days. The version, the person, that person, you know, who's loving, who acts, sorry, I should say performs sorrow. Because quite often, it ain't sorrow. It's, oh, I better learn to pull this lever and act like I'm sorry because it'll get me what I want. You know, who shows up with everything that you need. I mean, how much of the trap is actually built in those good moments and really not the bad ones?
That's everything. Because if a relationship started off with everything terrible, nobody would bond, you know? But it's that charming, manipulative, adoring, the affection, the promises, that offering comfort. That's how people get hooked. And that's what creates the trauma bond. And people have the ability to kind of do this compartmentalizing or this splitting where they will see an abusive side to their partner, but they rationalize because of this attachment in the limbic system that feels so good. And they'll say, but that's not the real him, or that's not the real her. And they just had a bad day at work. And that's why they came home and kicked the dog and put a hole in the wall, you know, and threatened me. but that's not real. And so when that honeymoon phase kicks back in, the love bombing is thick. It is intense. And it feels so good emotionally. And that's what people keep going back through. We talk about so much about intermittent reward. And, you know, this started with rat studies decades and decades ago, that a rat will press the lever for the food pellet more if it gets the reward intermittently. If it gets a reward every time it presses the pellet lever, it's not that motivated. But if maybe once out of every three times, once out of every five times, they get the reward, then they keep going back, just trying to find what is the formula to get this reward here. And that's the premise behind gambling. And while I was recently in Las Vegas, and I stayed in a cheap hotel that was above a casino. So to get to breakfast, I had to walk through the casino at 7 a.m. And it was so depressing.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were sitting there in this noise and this creepy environment, sitting there at 7 a.m. And you know you've got an addict when you see that kind of thing.
Smoke in one hand and one arm in the other.
Yeah. And
that's a good morning. I was just doing that before we came in here. Why are we judging? I didn't think we judged. I'm kidding. But on that note, I want to ask this about, you know, the rats, you know, and I get it. I know the study. I understand that. But the difference, I would say, with people is this. When the rats are hitting the thing and they're not getting the food, but every once in a while they do get the food. So they do keep coming back. What if you had the foods, and I'm not saying someone should do this, but what if the system that gave the food electrically shocked the rats half the time, and then every once in a while it gave food? Because that's kind of of the dynamic of a coercive control relationship where you're getting not just no feedback, although sometimes that's true. The, you know, part of the abuse in these sort of relationships is ignoring the other person, but also it's active negative feedback, not just neutral feedback. How does that play into something? Because people, even with getting shocked, you know, figuratively every time from the person who's giving them the nugget, still keep going back. Even the extra negative doesn't hold them back.
Yeah, I think we can say our prefrontal cortex sort of gets in the way with that, because the person, we'll just use the term the abusive person or the abuser will really do this mind trick on the victim by convincing them that when they get the shock, when they get the bad reaction, it's their fault. It's their fault. If you had not done, so they confuse them. They confuse their perceptions of reality. If you had not told me to turn the stereo down, I wouldn't have blown up and smashed it. You know, that's a story from my own life, right?
Sure.
Don't complain about the music because something bad is going to happen. And so it's that eventual, and this happens incrementally over time, but where the victim starts to take the blame and the responsibility. And when you look back at it years later, people, when they're out of that relationship system, they look back and go, why didn't I see it? But at the time, they bought into this idea that, well, when that happened, it wasn't the real him or it wasn't the real her. And if I only would have managed things a little bit differently. And it's insidious the way that that kind of dynamic works with this kind of attachment trauma.
So, Shivana, I'm curious, when you have someone, as we've even seen in these cases, and even in your own from earlier in life, you recognize the pattern, she even recognized that she's being groomed. Is there a certain personality type or empathy level that blinds you from not being able, not blind you because they're not blind to it, but compels you to go along with it anyway? And then second part of that is, once you've been burned once in a trauma bond, and you're aware of it, what gets them trapped back into it again? I just keep going back to personality type and being able to see these things a million miles away. Yeah. What keeps them from being able to see it and avoid it rather than being sucked back in with all this awareness?
I think a lot of people do break free from it. You know, I often say our 20s are at the time we're experimenting with how to do relationships, and we make bad choices. Most people can look at a bad choice they made early on in their 20s and go, ooh, but they learn from it. And then they do become more aware of red flags. But there are people who repeatedly go back into relationships like that. And I think that's where there's just a real disconnect between the prefrontal cortex and that limbic system. But some people, if you were raised, as I was raised, that self-sacrifice is a virtue, and that giving, you talk about high empathy, giving is a virtue, or giving is, you know, religion, that's what you're supposed to do. Forgive, 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 forgive. Don't get angry.
IBLD.
yes, that kind of thing. That really sets people up to be victims. And, you know, over time, I can say the light bulbs for me started to come on. I had some good therapy that helped me see this pattern. But you really want to do that in therapy with people is connect those two parts of the brain that are disconnected, and that you really do deserve to live a life where you're not being scared by your partner all the time. And some people get there. Some people get there really quickly. They make one error in judgment, and they never do it again. And then other people, it sort of becomes their life cycle.
What are the predators seeing in these people that attracts them and says, all right, I got a live one here? Is there something they're emanating that makes them more attractive than someone else, or are these predators kind of casting big nets and see who bites?
I think they cast big nets and see where it works. But there's certainly a radar for kind, empathetic people who want to help. And I think it's that want to help, you know, you have a person who's maybe they've had arrests, but it wasn't their fault. You know, they were set up somehow, or maybe they've, you know, lost jobs repeatedly.
Victims.
Yeah. And and so they hook in with someone who's very compassionate, who listens to them, who buys their version of reality, which is usually very distorted, and is easy to give too much, maybe lets them move. Oh, you've lost your job. You don't have any money. Move in with me, you know? So they're
boundaries.
Looking,
it sounds like a lack of boundary setting early on.
Lack of boundaries is huge, huge.
Because I mean, I know a lot of empathetic people. You're an empathetic person. I'm an empathetic, you know, Todd and Tony are. But there's also those boundaries you see. As soon as you can see someone pressing up against the boundary, you're like, oh, there's fire where the smoke is, man. No netters here.
Yes, yes. One of the weird examples of that, and again, this is not in recent years. We're going back, you know, 30, how many years was I in my 20s? Was that 40 years ago? 30? I don't know. It's been a long time ago.
10.
Yeah, we'll just say that. So this is not me today. I'm very careful about boundaries, but I was not as a young woman because I was not taught that I had the right to have any boundaries. Right. And so in my 20s, when I hooked up with the abusive person in my life, the one that I described that whole relationship in my book, he did not do very well with maintaining employment because of his own personality problems. But he was always out of money. I let him move in with me way too soon. And of course, I had a nest, I had a home and, you know, functional life. He did not. And when I would say, gee, you really do need to get a job here, you know, you need to kick in. I'm not asking you for everything, but can you pay half of what it costs to live here? And his line, which I bought, was, you don't want me to enjoy my life. How cruel of you. You don't want me to enjoy my life. And that would shock me. Well, of course I want you to enjoy your life.
Says every freeloader.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
How stupid was that? And I look back now on that young woman and I just go, man, she was a sitting duck. And there was history behind that. But I think a lot of people are in that situation.
And I think a lot of people, as we go back to like, how did they get in that situation? I think this is a true statement for a lot of us. I think it was true for me in my 20s. And I don't know, it probably resonates with some other folks out there too. And it all depends on, you know, basically the recipe that's made you up to that point in your life, the people you've been around, the people who've raised you, all that, where where sometimes when you encounter someone who is genuinely kind, and I'm not talking about the narcissist that's putting on a performance, I'm talking about a genuinely kind, well-meaning, empathetic human being. If you've been so surrounded by chaotic people your entire existence, that kind person feels chaotic. It doesn't feel authentic. It doesn't feel real. You question it. You feel uneasy around it. I feel uneasy around kind people a lot of times, unless I really get to know them. And like, I feel good about all you. I've known you all for years now. I feel good. But I tell you, I have that in my mind where I feel uneasy around people who have genuinely good intentions sometimes. Because it all reads to me as there's something else behind the curtain. And that's not true of everyone. Yep. Sometimes it is. And you get confirmation bias when you see it. Like, see, I knew they were shitty. Yep. But that's not every time. And when you are brought up in that chaos then equals kind. And you think, oh, it's chaos. And it's familiar. It's what you're used to. And especially, and this is what I think reinforces it for so many of us, especially in younger years, like you were saying, that the self-sacrifice is a virtue.
Yeah.
And that is usually connected in through a tentacle called religion. And again, I'm not going on religion is evil route here. I'm not. But when that is pounded into your head amongst chaotic people, that your suffering is virtuous and it's good. Mm-hmm. These other people out here in the world, they need you. They need you to help them get through. You feel like I'm doing good. I'm this person's rock. I'm this person's support. Mm-hmm. Never mind. I'm like being completely destroyed inside and I have no idea who the hell I am at the end of the day, but at least they're happy. Mm-hmm. At least they're comfortable. Mm-hmm. In this case, Micah Miller's husband was also her pastor. So you have social signals here. And that's another big thing that I think weighs on a lot of this. The social signals of the circle that you're in. And a lot of people don't talk about this. When the person hurting you is also the person your whole community respects, when your social world, your friendships, your sense of purpose are all wrapped in the same person,
social
and that
proof.
Person happens to have a connection to God.
Right. I mean,
add that in to the mix as well. And it doesn't even need it. Sometimes if it's just the social circle, that's powerful enough, but it's even worse when that person is the direct line between you and eternal salvation. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that?
Totally. Very, very, very confusing. And victims have learned over time with this abusive person not to trust their own perceptions, not to feel their feelings, you know, so they may live with guilt, fear, shame, depression, anxiety, but they try really hard not to pay attention to those things. And they are more apt to believe what they're told reality is, particularly when it's someone who has the pipeline to God and everybody else respects them. So it takes them a lot longer to get it.
Another statement I find interesting by people like that is, and people rationalize being in these horrendous relationships, and statements like, every relationship requires hard work. I'm telling you, I then want you to define what hard work is to you, because that's where my red flags are, because every good, healthy relationship I have doesn't require any work at all, man. Yeah. It just is. If you got to do some hard work, it's a good question to ask. Tell me what hard work looks like and what you're working around and working over, because a good, healthy, strong relationship, it's maintenance, I think, is an easier word than hard work.
Yeah, I don't know. Work is the right. I think work is used incorrectly.
Yeah,
I think work is a word that might be used by a narcissist because it is work for them. Where if it's a healthy relationship, it's not. I mean, if you're having, I mean, it takes effort. It takes care. It takes
like
depth
maintenance
there. Yeah, I like maintenance too.
Maintenance is a better word. 100% agree. Yeah. And for me, the hard relationship was where I felt threatened all the time, where I had to walk on eggshells, and I was always trying to find a fix. You know, will it be this therapy? Will it be that? Will, you know, if I just communicate better, you know, is there a fix? That's hard work, because in truth, we don't have the power to change another person like that. But the maintenance is more along the lines of negotiating with my husband, can you get the electronics out of the kitchen? You know, please. Right. Little stuff like that. And he'll say, you know, did you remember to give the dog his medicine for his arthritis today? So there's, and I can't you do it? You know, I'll do it.
Tweaking it's like communication.
Always tweaking communication. But your relationship should make you feel calm. You should feel supported. You should feel like this person is your best friend that you can go to with anything and that they listen and that they're there. And, you know, so many relationships, when they're saying it's hard work, it's like, no, you're pounding your head against the block wall and you're the one getting bruised here. And yeah, that's hard, but that's not changing the relationship.
I have a word my wife absolutely abhors when I use to describe us because she said it's the most unromantic word ever, but it's so accurate. We're compatible.
Yeah.
Compatibility just makes maintenance so seamless. And you just tweak the language. You tweak communication. But it's when you have good, healthy, strong people in these relationships, it just flows. This isn't say that you're in bad, anyone listening is in a bad one. It's just, hey, if there's smoke, just see if there's any fire going on there before you keep moving down.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that's when couples counseling can actually be beneficial. When absolutely. People have an essentially good relationship, they care about each other. They're collaborative. Their heart's in the right place. But maybe they're having a glitch. Mm-hmm. And if it's just a glitch, you can see a therapist, talk about communication, clear up the misconceptions that may be going on. I don't feel loved because, you know, you're playing golf so often. And it's like, oh, okay, I didn't understand that. How can we fix that? But so often, couples counseling is more about the lines of a person with a severe personality pathology. And the therapist is not powerful enough to fix that.
Right.
And so when I have done counseling, couples counseling in the last 10 to 20 years, I always see partners separately. And I want to look for, are there abusive things going on that maybe they won't say in front of each other? And some of my best work, I think, has been getting through to the person who's being abused. That comes up, maybe that doesn't come up at all when they're in front of each other because they're frightened, but helping them see that what you are living with is not healthy for you. And so they end up splitting up. So sometimes I think that's good. Couples therapy is helping people get away from each other.
Nice. I completely agree. A quick question. I mean, how often in the situations where you do see the two together, does the person who is actually the abuser play the victim?
Very often, very
yeah.
often.
Yeah.
And very often they're the charming person.
Yeah.
You know, and the other person is so beaten down, they may not even talk a lot because yeah. they've got severe anxiety and depression. And yes, I'm pretty good at spotting the games at this mm-hmm. point, and that's just years and years and years. But I'm always suspicious of somebody who comes in playing the victim and yet is incredibly charming and dominates the conversation.
Who's talking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why the only way I will do it, I mean, I try not to do too much of it anymore because you run into so much of this access to personality problems, but I would always see them separately as well.
Yeah.
And so you sort of see them together the first time and get a read on who's dominating here and what's the story that's being told, and then see them separately. And sometimes when you see them separately, you get the real behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. The links are in the description. How does a person lose themselves so slowly that they don't really notice until they're gone? Asa Alip was married to Rex Ehrman for 27 years and says she never saw who prosecutors allege he really was. Eric Richens in the Corey Richens story, just being sentenced as we speak, saw it completely. He told his family his wife would be responsible if anything ever happened to him and still couldn't leave. Two people, opposite experiences, same result. They stay. The psychology behind that is something every person in a relationship needs to understand because it doesn't start with a killer. It starts with a small compromise you barely notice. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us to help break it all down. Siobhan explored that exact erosion in her Substack, Spotlight on Psychology. And now she's here to break it down for us. Let's start with the version most people think they'll never fall for, the slow kind. The kind where nothing dramatic happens. No black eyes, no screaming, just years of small adjustments until one day you don't recognize yourself anymore. Let's walk through how that actually works, because I think a lot of women and men are living right now in situations like this. And, you know, they don't necessarily have a name for it. And they have, more importantly, a lot of excuses for it because they don't want to face the reality of what might actually be in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely happens incrementally, a little bit at a time. And then there's this kind of splitting where they tell themselves during the good times, well, this is who this person really is. And the bad times, I'll hear people say, well, he's just going through job stress right now. Well, he's been going through that job stress for 25 years, you know. So let's be realistic. But they lose their perspective because the abusive partner is telling them they're wrong all the time. And they start to feel they can't trust their perspective. And so they shut down. They often develop anxiety problems. They develop depression. And so often, you know, anxiety and depression, it can be endogenous. It can come from inside. You know, some people just have genetics that make them more anxious and depressed. But sometimes it's coming from the relationship. But that abusive partner will turn the tables on them and say, well, I wouldn't be so frustrated with you if you weren't so anxious and depressed all the time. So really, the person that is causing the anxiety and depression is blaming the victim and saying, you're the reason I'm the way I am. And it gets very convoluted in their mind. They also can become very isolated because the abusive partner often tends to not want them to have outside reality testing with other people who might give feedback that this really isn't very good for you. And so they mistrust their own perceptions. They don't get reality from other people who might have a more realistic perspective on it. And it's insidious. It can go on till they really don't have much of a sense of self anymore.
Yeah. I'm going to say this real quick, Robin.
Yeah, sure.
Narcissists, they're not necessarily, in my opinion, saying they're implicitly, here's my goal for this relationship. Mm-hmm. It's just what they do. And it seems to be always inflict mental vertigo. That seems to be the goal with anybody that becomes one of their targets or their victims. Because with vertigo, I mean, it's a debilitating condition. You can overcome it. There's ways, there's medication, there's things. But when you're in the throes of it, you don't want to leave your bed. You don't want to get up and go around. I mean, it's the same sort of thing with a controlling, coercively controlling narcissist or covert narcissist, because they're inflicting that mental vertigo. And the only person who can help you get around and get out of bed is them. Mm-hmm. It's that's really what's going on there. I'm sorry, Robin, go ahead.
No, it's all part of the same. I'm curious, Siobhan, so many aspects of this sound and look a lot like, you know, these really, really micro cults. Yeah, that's an interesting one, micro cult. And do you see it like this as well? Because you talk about isolation, and that's a huge part of grooming is isolation. Mm-hmm. But are we seeing it in Rex Huerman? And it's almost like Duggar-like, where it's not just the isolation, because I think people have an easier time recognizing when they're isolated, but these people then also will cascade the isolation by saying it's us against the world. Mm-hmm. We have the right view. They have the wrong view, and a good health and our relationships work. It takes work to be special. So mm-hmm. they make them feel special at the same time as the abuse is going on. Are they doing this? So is that part of the isolation that they're doing?
Yeah, I think very much. And I like the analogy to a cult, because in a cult, you have a dominant leader who's charismatic and can influence other people's perceptions. And it does become us against the world. And people buy into that. They don't have conscious awareness of what they're doing, but they want to keep the victim wants to keep the abuser happy, because when they're not happy, things get worse. And yeah. So they will give up parts of themselves. Maybe they'll quit college. I've seen that, you know, he doesn't want her getting educated and getting a job because he'll lose control.
And I imagine it might even be even more powerful for those wackadoos that are doing it, in the sense that, so when the spouse or the partner isn't sharing with others outside the isolation, because, you know, in some cases, a lot of cases, we see that they're afraid to share, you know, about what's going on because they're enamored with, or they've been groomed by the main perpetrator. But if they've been groomed into thinking they're special, they don't want to out them as a couple because she feels, that is just, it's doubly bad, because it's not even to protect, you know, and rationalize in a way the perpetrator, but she thinks she's part of it, that they think they're special. And I don't mean to, male-female role on this, because I know it can reverse as well, like in the Corey Richards case. But yeah, that us versus the world thing can be very horrendous.
Very true.
Yeah. I mean, it gets set up, it gets positioned by the abuser to the person they're abusing, that they are an enmeshed unit, that basically a strike against one is a strike against both of us. Right. They become their own little UN. And then, anybody, you know, that is going against them, well, then, you know, you get personally offended if somebody's, you know, even rightfully calling out some of the chaos of the abuser, but because you have become part of that identity. And quite often, I think sometimes then they lure you into doing things that you are going to feel your own shame about. So if you're calling them out on their shame that they should, well, they can just as easily then cast that stone right back at you. And they know that little pebble they can throw over at you and say, see, it's going to hit you like a boulder would hit them. Mm-hmm. But they know how to control you, and they know what triggers you. That's part of the power. I think a big part of this, and it's interesting because if we're talking about the Asa Alwerbrechts-Hiermann case and the Corey Richens-Eric Richens case, you have two people there who stayed. Asa, because she didn't believe, she just didn't know, in her words. She stuck her head in the sand, in my opinion. And we can go down that road in another day, but whatever it is, I don't believe she genuinely had any clue what the hell was going on.
I agree.
Her. And, okay, you know, too. Whether or not she could have, you know, it would be your choice to look, but I don't think she did. And then you have the case of Eric and Corey Richens, where Eric saw it. He's warning his friends. He's telling people, if I'm dead, it's because of her. But each of them stayed. And at the end of the day, well, Asa had no clue. There's kids involved. She's there for the kids. Eric, he knew everything was going to shit and feared for his own safety, but again, stayed for the kids.
Right.
People do this. I stayed for the kids until there was no choice, until we almost all get murdered one day. The moment where you realize that confronting who your partner really is means detonating your children's entire world, that keeps people frozen.
Good word.
I guess the question I have, I mean, I know that was my reason. That's like Eric's reasons, a lot of people's reasons for staying in bad relationships. Why is that? Why can we not see beyond where we're at? And honest to God, Siobhan, to this day, if I had to go relive it again, I don't know that I would have done a whole lot different. I think I probably would have stayed still, you know, as long as it took until I knew there was a safe off-ramp for my daughter and myself. And I took it when I had the chance, and I'm glad I did. But I had to wait for that off-ramp. And that off-ramp could have meant me being dead. Thank God it didn't. Yeah. But a lot of parents are in that same situation. What do you say to them?
Yeah, parents will tolerate an enormous amount of suffering if they believe that it's ultimately going to protect their children. And that's, you know, it's just tragic. The other thing about Eric, it looks like to me that he was in the process of leaving, but he was doing it incrementally and slowly. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it was too slow. He didn't do it quick enough. And I can't imagine laying in the same bed when you're conscious that the person next to you very likely is going to kill you, or, you know, has the agenda to poison you. How would you sleep?
Yeah, we just don't accept. I mean, so much has been written on this. We as a human, as a species, never really fully embrace that our mortality, that we could possibly die.
Sure.
And I think we give the benefit of the doubt too often on that. And part of this, in all these cases, and Tony, you hit it, until you had an off-ramp, how do people recognize potential off-ramps, and are there more than we recognize?
I think people need the number one thing that helps people is to start talking, you know, to someone, to be honest with friends, as Eric was doing, you know, letting people know this is how bad it is. I'm thinking of getting out, and then start making plans to get out. And it sounds like he was in that process. He just didn't move fast enough. And because you don't usually go from one day being, you know, completely committed to your partner, and the next day you're gone. You know, you work your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And there are various steps that people go through. So, and he also may have had fear that she would get sole custody of the kids.
Yeah.
And that she was not a safe person because of that. And yep. So, you know, how do you navigate this? It's really complicated.
The courage to communicate to start it, I guess.
Right? Her kids actually released a statement yesterday, and I'm going to be doing a piece on it later in the week. They're calling her Corey, and they're happy she's away, and they hope to God she never gets free because they fear for their own safety.
Oh.
Is there... their attitude. What it takes to go from mom to Corey, I hope she's never free because I'm afraid for my own safety. That's a journey. It's a journey my own daughter has gone on. And I get it. But it's quite a journey for a child to connect all those dots in that way.
Frankie too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ruby Frankie too. Yeah. I want to go back to one more thing on this. You know, Eric was moving slow. He was starting to put the building blocks in place. He seemed to know he had to find an off-ramp. I don't think he identified the off-ramp yet, but okay. I think he was waiting for it. And then there's folks who go really fast. We all know that the window there, when the abuser knows you're out, that you're leaving, the jig's up, game's over. That's the most dangerous time of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So Eric went slow. Other people go too fast. It's not necessarily about speed, but it's about protecting yourself and your children the best you can when the inevitable arises. I guess, what do you speak to that? Because I think people are confused sometimes going, do I do it really fast and just get out? And, you know, do I slowly build this up? What is the right? Is there a right? What do you say to that?
It's really complicated. Yeah. And that's why I always encourage people to, if they're in this situation, find a domestic violence counselor. And this can be somebody through the National Domestic Violence Hotline who do wonderful work. It can be a private therapist if they have training in working with domestic violence cases. Not all do. So it's okay to ask up front, do you have training in this? But I think it has to be done on a very individual basis with the idea of safety in mind, because 50% of women murdered in the U.S., 60% if you look globally, are killed by a partner or former partner, romantic partner. And a good percentage of those are happens when they're trying to exit or right after they have exited. So, and sometimes this is typically also what happens in the familicide, where the person comes in and kills, usually a man, kills the wife, kills the kids, kills himself. And that's usually at the time that the victim is trying to get out.
Yeah. So when people start losing control, or they feel like they're losing control, they go nuts.
Yeah.
Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Those links are in the description. Let's continue the conversation over here to Hey, look, a new graphic. The retrial of Alec Murdaugh. Huh. Yeah.
Tony's on the move already.
That's a little big news today. Then we're talking, I want to talk specifically about Maggie Murdaugh here. This is not a segment where we're going to dive super into the retrial, but trust me, it's coming. So press subscribe. There's a lot of info that'll be coming down on that. There's that window we just talked about, deciding to leave and actually being gone. Most people think of that, that's a hopeful part. I mean, it can be mentally, but in terms of safety, it's not. It's the most dangerous part. Maggie Murdaugh had reportedly already consulted an attorney. She was living apart from Alec. On June 7th, she didn't want to go to Moselle. Two witnesses testified to that. She went anyway. We've covered the Murdaugh case extensively. This conversation isn't about Alec. It's about that window, what happened inside of it. And what women listening right now, or men right now, need to know if they're standing in a similar dynamic. Siobhan Scott is with us. So she wrote about this on her Substack, Spotlight on Psychology. The links are on our Substack. Those are in the description. The research is showing the danger spikes the moment someone tries to go. And like I said, we just talked about that. I want to talk about, obviously, we know that's dangerous, but what about the lines of communication with your abuser once you're out? She allegedly already living in like the beach house, and she was staying in a different place. Insert anybody's, you know, situation here, already out, I'm there, and you're working on your next direction into where you're going that doesn't include that person. Oftentimes, if there's not necessarily what one would traditionally consider, you know, direct abuse, meaning physical direct abuse, I mean, we don't put enough weight on psychological, even though we should. But a lot of times people, they're not hitting me, they're not doing that.
Right.
So I'll at least keep those lines of communication open. Mm-hmm. This seemed to be an example of maybe where there shouldn't be any lines of communication, because essentially she was lured in under a false pretense to show up at that house, allegedly by alleged murder, because we can't say he's a murderer anymore, alleged murderer, Alec Murdaugh. That's what that Supreme Court changed. When you have that going on, and you think the least possible, you don't think that person is capable of those things when you're in that situation. Do we, as people, tend to really overlook the dangers in those moments, especially when those people are trying to lure us in for really not substantial moments? Like, there's really no reason she needed to go back to the house that night. And I think a lot of controlling people will try to exercise those levers of control in that situation, not always immediately doing horrible things, but saying just how willing you are to comply with their demands of control.
Yeah. Yeah. And minimizing the risk, as you said, because he, as far as we know, had not made a fist and punched her in the face, you know? So she was manipulated in all sorts of ways, controlled in all sorts of ways, but just didn't think she was in the kind of danger that she was actually in. So I always caution people about, you know, don't minimize what could potentially be a very dangerous situation here. And it's just tragic because she was clearly trying to take the exit ramp.
Go ahead, Tony. Sorry.
I was just going to say, and that's an interesting thing because, I mean, immediately I think a lot of us in those sort of situations, coercive controls situations, we're thinking about the quick crescendo that's going to happen. If I just stop communicating, if I ignore them, it's going to be hell to pay. They're going to freak the F out and they're going to really act out on it. And usually it will subside a bit, but we don't want to even approach that. We've been conditioned not to approach that. So we appease, we keep, you know, keep them just happy enough to keep them at bay. Is the real lesson here more so just don't? Just if you don't need to communicate, don't. If they need something, they don't need it. They can handle it. There's nothing you're going to offer them that they absolutely need right now. So don't do it out of convenience. Don't do it out of consideration. Is it more so if there's no real reason for communication? I mean, should it always have a functional term, something maybe around the kids or something? Or should it just really be none at all? And if you want to have any sort of connection here, we're going to do it in a supervised environment.
Right.
Is that almost always the best advice to take?
It's hard to say if it always is, but sometimes it is the best advice. And I encourage some people to disappear for a while, you know, to even though we know cases where somebody tried to disappear and then they were stalked and ultimately had, had a tragic outcome. But a lot of people, if they have that intuition that this person is going to escalate when I leave, it's like, you know, don't just cease communication, get yourself away and, you know, don't let them know where you're at, block their number and, you know, just stop it. Sometimes that's the best thing.
Yeah. It's we're really good at picking up on these wobbles, especially if you've been traumatized by someone because you know their pattern of behavior. And then if they're escalating, you're really going to recognize as well, have that trust in your intuition on that, because it's based on not just a one-off gut feeling. It's based on reps with them. I'm curious, Siobhan, is there a difference in the predator's behavior between someone that is, you can maintain communication with because of the children being involved and someone who actually is going to continue to escalate into severe violence potentially that can help anyone, or should they just go radio silent entirely?
It's a really hard one to call because, you know, I'm sure you have studied this stuff. What's the best predictor of future behavior, past behavior? Yeah, have they been violent before? Have they threatened you before? You know, we know that trying to strangle people is a big predictor of you're going to eventually get killed. So if you see risk factors like that, you're really in danger and you need to disappear.
I'm sorry. So is that really a good then rule of thumb? If there's ever been physical violence, that's when you got to definitely have to go into hiding.
I would advise somebody in that. Yeah, just disappear. If there's somebody that owns a bunch of guns and they're into guns, or they've ever made threats to shoot people, you know, if you see that kind of volatility, get away. You know,
and this is the hardest thing I know for people that are suffering this, because it's so unjust, because they shouldn't have to be going to hiding. They shouldn't have to hide. They shouldn't have to isolate themselves from the entire world. But unfortunately, that's the reality of what they're going to have to do, because we keep seeing again and again these horrendous cases where they are stalked, hunted down, and ultimately murdered by these by these bag of bad genetic coding.
I want to pass this one by, because I think a lot of people probably have this question when they're in that situation, and it comes to blocking of phone numbers, blocking on social media, blocking wherever you can put a block up digitally. And I get sometimes there are situations where there are kids involved and there is joint custody, and there has to be some sort of line of communication in existence. And that doesn't always necessarily mean social media or a phone number. Sometimes that can be an intermediary, and that can be handled that way. There's apps that handle these sort of things for parents that can't get along. There's a lot of options. It doesn't always require direct contact. But from someone, when you're getting out of it, and if you have to have that, there's that. But that's not always the case. Sometimes you don't need to have any contact. There's not the kids involved.
Right.
So you're left with kind of a conundrum at a certain point, especially if the person is going to act out and they're going to go online and they're going to say horrible things about you or whatever. They're going to try and smear you in their smear campaigns, which a lot of narcissists do. You have two options. You can either continue to follow that person if they haven't already blocked you. You can keep their number open in case they contact you, so you have a record of whatever they're saying to you. And you're keeping your thumb on that pulse. Maybe not reacting, but you're still consuming whatever you're seeing they're saying, and you're aware. And then there's the other side to the coin of block them. You have peace. You're not consuming that information. It's not there to fuck with your head. But then you also don't have your thumb on the pulse of what might be going on out there, about what they might be saying. Because you don't know. Sometimes they may, sometimes they may not. I guess, what is the best choice to make? I mean, in that sort of situation. I mean, if you're there to, obviously, if there's a danger that might be presented that you really want to be aware of, it's probably good to somewhat of a flashlight out there. But is it always the best thing to not just block, I don't need to see whatever you're going to say. You're going to say it. It's going to settle. You don't need me to do this. Me being aware of it's not going to help anything. That's a big choice a lot of people have of blocking or to block or not to block. Siobhan, right. Where do you stand?
Right, right. I would probably lean toward blocking. And if you really feel like, you know, it's going to be helpful to know where is this person living? Are they ranting about, you know, how awful I am online to all their friends? Are there any, you know, posing with guns in Facebook? I mean, people do really stupid things on social media. Maybe have a friend that knows them, do the monitoring and just kind of keep you alerted if there's something that, you know what, this really looks like a red flag. I think you need to get a restraining order or talk to an attorney or, you know, so many things people need to do. Alert their workplace that if he shows up at work, you know, it's an immediate 911 call. And, you know, there's pros and cons, as you say, of each approach. But I think it's certainly better overall if when you get away, you're not staying completely focused on that person and not letting them disrupt your sense of safety and peace in the world. But in truth, bad things happen. We've had cases here locally where I live in Portland of a guy going into a hospital where his wife was a nurse and after she had left him, killing her in the hospital. So these things do happen and it's just hard. Some people will telegraph that they're becoming increasingly unstable and angry in advance. And if somebody is aware of that in your circle, it would be nice to have that information.
Yeah, I'm wholeheartedly with Siobhan on this. Yeah. You block, and then you sensitize what I call sensitize your safe circle. You know, you sensitize your environment around you about what's going on, what's happening, use transparency and openness. Mm-hmm. And when you sensitize people towards behaviors and people, it's like, I call it the new car effect. You know, the day we bought the car we drive, all of a sudden, poof, we start seeing it everywhere. Mm-hmm. These people that are compassionate and empathetic towards you are going to recognize the behavior wobbles if you sensitize them to it. But you don't require... Don't allow them to take up that free space in your brain and just you sensitize that safe bubble around you for the wobble alerts.
That's a really good one. Yeah, that's a good one. Good way to put it.
Mm-hmm. You should go to your friend and go, will you be my official wobble alerter?
Wobble alert.
And see how they react.
You should make an app. Conversation.
Uh-huh. Robin asked me to be a wobble alerter. I don't know what that means. But
or a wobbler.
A wobbler. I saw a comment here about someone saying how they were listening to this and it reminds them of their marriage. Yeah, a lot of this hits home to a lot of people. I have a book for you. I recommend this one, Nightbird by Siobhan 100%. Scott. She happens to be here on the show right now. It goes into her experiences, so I do highly recommend this. Another one I would recommend, if you're having some revelations here as you're watching this or listening to this, Dr. Ramani has a good book out. It's Not You is out, and I suggest that one too. It helps connect a lot of dots, especially because, I mean, it's you're like, oh, it's all in front of me. It's nice to have someone kind of help put those pieces together when you're feeling like it's utterly chaos. One more question for both of you, since we're on the topic of the Murdaughs. We'll go off Maggie for a second. Alec Murdaugh looks like he's getting a new trial for murder. That's why we have to say allegedly a murder. The South Carolina Supreme Court
convicted.
5-0 throughout his conviction. And now it goes back to the circuit court. The circuit court has already said, the judge there said, if it goes back to us, we will seek a new trial. The people who are looking to replace that circuit judge have all also said, we will seek a new trial. So it looks pretty imminent there's going to be a new trial. They basically have the option of new trial or we're going to dismiss the charges. Dismissing highly, highly unlikely at this point. New Alec Murdaugh trial likely to take place. It's all because of Becky Hill's undue influence on the jury, a juror flat out saying, she influenced me, and the South Carolina Supreme Court going, yeah, we can't have that. It's not about Alex, the evidence against him, how shitty of a human being he allegedly is, all of his convicted crimes of finance. It goes back to somebody didn't follow the damn rules. And now we have to try this again. Siobhan, I'm going to go to you first. Your reaction to us now getting on the ride for Alec Murdaugh murder trial part 2.
Oh, it was such a painful, painful trial to watch. And he was such a despicable human being, and so much evidence of that over and over again. And then the murders were so horrendous. So, yeah, I'll watch. I can't say I enjoy the process.
We need to sell like merch for this, I think, where it's like triple ply Kleenexes, you know, with the Alec Murdoch face on the side because of all of his snot that was flying out when he took the stand at the first trial. Not single ply, not double ply, triple ply Kleenexes. Really make sure that stuff gets caught. Robin, what are your thoughts?
You know, when I saw this, the thing that popped in my mind is the greed of one per. Oh, yeah. Oh, thanks. I needed
triple
that.
Ply.
The greed of one human being undermine justice.
Yeah.
And greed destroys so much. And Becky Hill, you know, going in because she wanted a book deal, supposedly, you know, influencing things, you know, it just get over yourself, shut the hell up, do your job, and let justice work. And it didn't. She ruined the entire thing. The next thing I looked up was, is he still behind bars for the financial crime?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So yeah. Thank God for that. Thank God they pursued that.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, they'd be going for parole right now so he could be released while they're awaiting second trial, maybe. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah. And I have a lot of legal questions, and we'll start to address them tomorrow. Eric Fatt is going to be with us. It's going to be all about this. Because I do wonder about that trial. I mean, he pled guilty essentially because he was eviscerated on the financial crimes in the trial that wasn't about the financial crimes.
Right.
So if I don't know if there's an argument there legally to be made of, yeah, he wouldn't have done that had this not happened over here. And the Supreme Court has even said in their piece that you went too far in the financial crimes in the murder trial. Not saying they can't touch it, but they're saying 12 days was a bit excessive. And you gotta roll that back a little bit. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like, I mean, right now as it sits, even if he's found innocent of the murder, he will be in prison for the rest of his life based on the financial crimes.
He pled yes. guilty to the financial crimes.
And that's what I'm wondering if there's any, I don't know. I don't know if there's any leeway there. That's a good legal question to ask. But there, it really throws so many things up in the air. I got a text late last night from some folks very closely connected to the case saying, by the way, this is going to be coming down
pretty
soon.
Wondering how you got that out so fast.
And I was like, really? I think it's Monday. I'm not sure yet. We're still trying to work out the details, but Blanca Simpson is going to be joining us, me and Robin. She was Alec Murdoch's housekeeper. You saw her portrayed in the movies. She went on the stand. She's been a part of this case. She's the one who was there after Gloria Satterfield, I believe, and really has a lot of insight into the case. That night, she was there at Moselle. Right after the murders took place, she's already been on the show. You can go back and watch that interview on the feed. Blanca Simpson, just look it up. We'll probably rerun it here soon. But she's going to come on and give us her reaction to all this. And there's a boatload of things that never made it into the trial that are rather important. And I'm wondering what will make it this round. She's almost surely going to be called as a witness again. So she'll be joining us here on the program in the next handful of days to discuss this big update. So press subscribe so you don't miss any of that.
And it's Judge Newman. He retired though, right?
Newman's done. Yeah.
That's a shame. He was so good.
The question is, the assumption at this moment in time is, will Creighton Waters be the one that prosecutes Alec Murdaugh again? I would say maybe let's try somebody else this round. I mean, I know he got the job done, but there again, the financial stuff went a bit much. And I don't know.
I think they're going for change of venue too, I think, right?
I don't know the answer to that question. Right. You'd almost have to, I think, at this point. Put in another country, because I don't know that you're going to, you know, get a whole, I don't know. I mean, it's
Alaska.
It is chaos in the South Carolina Lowcountry this morning as of our recording with that ruling coming down. But there's a lot coming here on the show, and it's a press subscribe. Siobhan Scott's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go and check it out. Robin Dreek's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available also wherever you get books or audiobooks. Go and check them out. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, Lady Luck?
Bretzky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just $10.
$10 for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.